This morning's Dharma talk will be given by Bamasui Zen Dharma teacher Jeff Sewell.
Morning. I thought I'd talk about the closing dedication that we just chanted. Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing right here, now. The wind blows. Waves fall on the shore, and Guanyin finds us in the dark and broken roads. We give thanks to all the ancestors of meditation in the still halls, the unknown women and men, centuries of enlightened women and men, ants and sticks and grizzly bears. Let wisdom go to every corner of the house. Let people have joy in each other's joy. A few weeks ago, I went skiing with a couple of Swedes, and at the end of the day, I asked what I thought was a rather innocent question. Did you have a nice time? And one of the two, who I've known for 5 or 6 years and has become a good friend, and who now lives here in the States, said it was a great day. But the other, who I'd only just met and who does not live in the States, didn't respond. And I looked at my friend and sort of shrugged my shoulders, and he smiled and then said, "You know, the question you've just asked is sort of an uncomfortable question for a Swede." He went on to explain, as many of us I think know, that Swedish culture is fairly collectivist, and in theory at least, everyone's supposed to have an equivalent experience. That's the ideal. So they told me a question like the one I just asked puts a Swede in a bit of a bind. If they say I have had a good experience or a bad experience or something in between, they're engaging in a sort of act of social comparison that's discouraged. And my friend has known me long enough and lived in the States long enough that he felt compelled to respond, but not so with the other guy. And they went on to explain that there are some real downsides to this norm, and according to them, a lot of Swedes sort of live with this pervasive sense of jealousy that can become seething at times, and there isn't any socially sanctioned way to sort of release it, gossip or complaining or whatever. And one of the things they said about this is that it can make it really hard for people to take joy in others' joy. And I found this all really fascinating. And I said that, in our culture, at least the little slices of it of which I feel a part, the ideal was very different. It was to take joy in other people's joy. I said we were, probably completely miserable at practicing that much of the time, but that was the ideal at least. And during this discussion, I was of course thinking about this closing dedication that we just chanted. I really, really appreciate all of our dedications. To me, one of the points in the liturgy that really sort of seems to address the why question of our practice, or the so what of our practice. And among the various dedication verses, I've always really appreciated this one, especially. It seems somehow to me to have a little bit of a different quality than the others. Buddha nature pervades the whole universe, existing right here, now. Each of the dedications opens with some line, this line or another, that sort of strikes me as a reminder or a call, a statement of fact, or you know, if you prefer, an article of faith. We're alive. All's alive. All is blessed. Notice this. Be awake to it. But from here, all the other dedication verses proceed sooner or later to lines that seem to me, at least, to be kind of more clearly cut in the nature of a dedication. We dedicate our practice to all beings, or to those who are suffering from calamity, cruelty, oppression, or war. But this verse goes on, the wind blows, waves fall on the shore, the morning bell rings, birds sing. It was amazing to hear birds today. The first time I felt like I'd forgotten what a bird sounds like. An email arrives. These lines seem to me like more reminders. Buddha nature pervades the whole day. And Guan Yin finds us in the dark and broken roads. Compassion, at least in my experience, does seem to have a way of finding us on our dark and broken roads. And, you know, perhaps many of us are more open to a helping hand and the love that fills the whole universe when our own hearts feel particularly empty, you know, when we feel lost or down. That love, of course, is exactly the same love that is the wind blowing, that is the wave falling on the shore, pounding against my chest, that is the email arriving. We give thanks to all the ancestors of meditation in the still halls, the unknown women and men, like us. Centuries of enlightened women and men. To me, this is the passage in the dedication that sort of feels more tending in the nature of clear-cut, you know, dedication, if you will. And yet it's phrased as an expression of appreciation for all this practice offers us and enables us to try to offer to others, for all the people who have developed it and sustained it and transmitted it to us. It's really precious and really something to cherish and preserve, sustain, and develop, as we're all trying to do here. And then we next hear ants and sticks and grizzly bears. Every time I hear this, I remember the first time I heard it and chanted it, and I laughed out loud, you know, in the sutra service. And it, it was one of those early moments when I knew that Zen was for me, that I was just completely hooked hearing this in liturgy practice. And the line is really playful, I think, in one way, and also completely serious, completely matter of fact. Buddha nature pervades everything, and we give thanks for everything, and sticks and bears among them. And it makes me think about Melissa's talk last night and the discussion we had afterwards. You know, we're also grateful. We also say yes to, you know, the things crawling around on the ground, including ourselves. And bears in our own bearishness and boorishness. Let wisdom go to every corner of the house. I don't hear this, so much as expansionist or missionary aspiration or whatever, but more just as another statement of fact. Wisdom is going to every corner of the house. Wisdom is the house. And as we were discussing last night, we have countless ways of resisting this and meddling with it. And it's so much just treading water. This line in the ants and sticks and grizzly bears part, I mean, you know, I guess at this point in the verse for me that I begin to appreciate that this really is a dedication. Turning to what is, and knowing we're a part of it, and dedicating ourselves to it. We are dedicated to it. We're just so part of it, and so giving ourselves over to it emotionally, spiritually. This is a dedication. And finally, let people have joy in each other's joy. I was thinking this is perhaps, for me, the pithiest little ethical mandate I know. And I don't have any doubt that, that our collective happiness would be a lot greater if collectively we could, you know, we could practice this more consistently. I also hear this line, like the others, as much as sort of description, as prescription. Joy is the way, the direction, the energy, the sort of frequency of the universe. To which we can tune in, with which we can cooperate. Let people have joy in each other's joy. Such a simple idea. And yet, it's the work of a lifetime, it seems. And it seems to be so over generations and across cultures. Thank you.
So please make yourselves comfortable. And we'll have our Dharma dialogue. You can call on people.
Thank you for that talk. I like that dedication a lot too. And what that one of the lines that at first I had trouble with was Kuan Yin finds us in the dark and broken roads, because the first time I heard it, it sounded kind of maudlin to me, like almost like a country western song. And I even have a tune for it, which is Kuan Yin finds us in the dark and broken roads. and it seemed like it didn't seem right to me, and so I kind of sat with it, and I realized, you know, something I've always known, but I think it's more, I think we feel it more intensely when we practice, which is that it's when you are broken down and, you know, and in pain that compassion arises in you. And I realized that for me, this line didn't mean that some external, you know, angelic agency came and helped me, but that when I was at my worst, I was most likely to feel compassion for others. That was Kuan Yin finding me. You know, all it takes is a really bad toothache, and you start to notice all the pain around you, and connect with it. And you know, and compassion is feeling with. You know, not pity is feeling for. Compassion is feeling with. So, in a sense, what your talk enabled me to see is that it's the same as taking joy in each other's joy, which is also a feeling with. That it's not even the flip side of compassion. I think it's kind of all compassion. It's all feeling with.
Thank you. Your comments make me realize how, you know, I guess it's a bit of a truism, but it is true, you know, that feeling the pain is, you know, unless we develop the capacity to really touch that, it blunts out, you know, obscures the ability to experience joy as well. And I think that's a bit of what, you know, what my Swedish friends were saying about this feature of their own culture. I know Melissa and David have spent a lot of time in Sweden, part of why I was so surprised to hear this is because I've been to, like, their Christmas dinners and stuff, and there's all this wonderful, and their crayfish festivals in the summer, and there's all this lovely thing. It just seems like a very joyful culture to me, but it was very interesting to hear this, yeah.
But in the other place in the Kuan Yin finds us, these dark and broken roads, and we did a chant this morning, the little one, actually, in our sutra service, and the idea is that, as you were saying, Jeff, life is compassion. We've been talking about that. This is the fundamental nature, and I go around thinking, "Where's the compassion? God damn it! You know, where is? I'm going to find it." But until we break down, we're utterly defended. You know, we are encapsulated perfectly. And this breaking down is required. And not that there's more compassion then. It's just that there's a little perforation where it gets through. And we see the truth that has been sustaining us from the moment we let out our first yelp. But mostly we think, well, I'm doing it. But when we get to that point where I can't do it, I'm not working, I'm broken, then we can receive what surrounds us, what we are. And I love that. It's that, you know, not, you know, so angel coming down to us, to me, is an explanation of something that is impossible to explain. Right, so where does this come from? But it's not some external thing. It's not something separate from us. So, yeah, thanks.
Well, and, you know, we also have to be careful here that we don't make a prescription So I'm going to feel compassion when I break down. So let's see, how could I break down? I can find some ways to do that. And this is one of the things I love about Zen practice, because it kind of constructs a set of circumstances for that opening. Because you're constricted. You have to sit still for periods of time and then get up and walk around and then sit again and then walk around. And so even for people who don't have any pain or suffering at all, there's some kind of clarity in that arises out of that, that limitation. I always think it's like practicing for the moment when we'll all be on our deathbeds. Well, if we're lucky, if we don't die in a sudden accident, but if we're on our deathbeds and we have so few choices, then we've all done this. So this is kind of like a rehearsal. I don't think it's a perfect rehearsal, because the real thing is probably different. But just to be careful that the mind can take all these things and make up a booklet, a how-to booklet. This is how I'm going to feel compassion. I also love the Swedish culture is a great mystery to me, because it is very joyous, and there's something. It's also Midwestern culture is similar, because I think there were a lot of Swedish immigrants who went out there. And there's also the other thing I was talking with somebody about the other day, the tall poppy. Have you heard of that? No. I can't remember what it is in Swedish, but you're not supposed to stand out, so you also shouldn't. It's like a poppy field, and there's one tall poppy. Right, right. You shouldn't be a tall poppy. Exactly. And it's that same thing, And it's kind of the opposite of American culture. And it seems like every culture has these extremes.
Yeah.
And in Zen practice, supposedly in Asia, it's easier to feel the communal nature of the Sangha than it is here. And I think that's true in Sweden as well. But it's harder to feel the passion and intensity of the self dissolving.
Right.
So every culture has its unique difficulties.
Yes.
And gifts.
Yes. I don't know your name.
Mark.
Mark. Okay.
I like the dedications. The part of the dedication really talk about grizzly bears, because you could imagine that you have this really dangerous creature that can kill you in an instant, without any problem. They run at like 30 miles per hour. They're unfair predators in a sense. But they go through things too. I mean, we're killing their habitat and so forth. So. You also have to think about it from that perspective, and the fact that the dedication actually considers, this really dangerous creature in a way, and you say, let's dedicate it to, these animals as well, is very powerful.
Yeah. Nothing left out, no perspective. Not our perspective on bears, and not the bear's perspective. Either. Thank you.
Thank you. I had a light bulb go off when I listened to you. The side of my father's family is 100% Swede. And all of a sudden I understood my Nana in a way I never could, of the clashing cultures, of standing out and not. They were at war in her. And also in listening to you and watching that whole side of my family from the Midwest, Minnesota, this sense that I've also inherited of we do so have an over-exaggerated sense of I here, but at the same time you can't legislate not having it. And that whole part of my family, which I've grown up, it's like, how do you do this? And then how it grows up kind of funny, like my Nana seemed to embody it, of trying to force herself, and I noticed how I inherited that, to be a certain way, and you can't do that, which is what you were saying about the jealousy, but no way to deal with it. So I have a sense of what I've inherited in a way I didn't know before. Thank you.
It's It's funny, you know, that individually, and I'm realizing from all these comments, collectively we have these strategies for dealing with this thing, the self, right? You know, and basically none of them work. You know, or as a friend of mine says about choices and, you know, different paths we can take in life, he always goes, "Oh, the grass is brown on both sides." and it's a little green and a little brown on both sides, you know, and so we inherit whatever we inherit. And one of the, you know, the Zen practice is lovely in so many ways, and just echo what Melissa was just saying. I mean, one way in which it's so lovely is, you know, it's this, we encounter, we explore, you know, all these strategies and rising in and around us, and see ultimately how they all just utterly fail us. And then perhaps, you know, glimpse that it's the project itself that's, you know, and something else has always been here. But it, like David said, I mean, you know, that realization comes 9 times out of 10, I guess, by reaching some sort of breaking point. It raises an interesting question about sort of what that is on a cultural or social level, you know, and I look around today and wonder whether in so many social contexts and features of the world that seem like, you know, what's the collective way to melt? Thank you.
I was just thinking, maybe it's trying to tell us that the universe is not a zero-sum game. That you could get yours and I can get mine too. And if anybody gets anybody's, it belongs to all of us.
Yeah, the theory that many of us carry around, that there's not enough to go around, which might derive from actual socioeconomic things, factors. But what Zen teaches us is that there's more than enough to go around. Mm-hmm. You know, the world is full of everything we need. Not in the most concrete level, but in some bigger heart level. This great compassion that we've been talking about, that everything is Kanzan. You know, which leads us to what Alan was saying, that Kanzan finds us, but it's really, we're finding Kanzan, we're finding Guanyin, and there's no separation, and there's this one whole thing, so there always is enough. You know, what does Dogen say in the precepts? Something like there's no sufficiency or lack.
Yeah, no excess and no lack.
No excess and no lack. It's just the right amount of everything. And we think there isn't. We generalize that to everything. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough energy. I don't have enough of this, that, or the other thing. But in each moment, it's enough. It suffices.
And I would say culturally, you know, Jeff, you mentioned that we have an ideal of taking joy in each other's joy, but I think just as strong is this competitive.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know, if you got it, I don't, and sort of that socioeconomically, but also personally, we can be sitting here and hear about someone's great experience, and so quickly we compare ourselves as less than. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm afraid, well, I'm never going to have the experience he had or she had. Yeah. You know, and not even, well, I guess it is a kind of jealousy that arises because I think I'm afraid I won't, that there isn't enough for me. Mm-hmm. You know, and that sense of not enough, so pervasive in our individualistic culture.
And very much in the zero-sum mindset.
That's right, yeah.
When you made your comments in the stream of consciousness, what flashed into mind for me is, you know, just I'm reading a book on cosmology right now, you know, by an MIT physicist. It flashed. The universe is expanding.
Wasn't that what terrified Woody Allen in one of his movies?
Right, old boy, depends on how you look at it.
The universe is expanding. That's on your view.
But, you know, apparently, since we're part of the universe in its fabric, we're expanding as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I saw this hysterical thing thinking about abundance. I was driving home, and on the hill, this person probably had so much trouble with the snow. It said snow for sale. Everybody in Mumbai thought that was absolutely hysterical. But there's more than enough.
Well, and that's like the image of selling water by the river. Mm-hmm. So these Zen teachings. You know, like, I've got this great secret. What is it? Well, we're alive. Don't tell anybody.
You dress it up in all this history. Just like,
what's the
you already
secret?
Have it.
That's a playfulness thing, too. That's just so great, I think. Ants and sticks and grizzly bears. And,
You know, there was this little movement for a while when we first... I believe that quote was written by John Terrence.
That's
what it might have been John Sutherland, but somebody in John Terrence's group at least wrote it. And at first there was like, well, we don't have any grizzly bears in New England, so we should replace that word with other words that are about animals that live here. So people were saying ants and sticks and squirrels and ants and sticks and raccoons. But hearing what Mark said, and then there was nobody, like there was this feeling of, no, well, let's not do that anymore at a certain point. And I think we got to stick with those grizzly bears, those scary, fast, huge things that come rushing at us. You know, Guanyin's finding us in the dark and broken roads. The grizzly bears are attacking. and grizzly bears Guanyin too.
I'm just thinking, John Terrence, Australia. I mean, where they use wombats. Or, what you're saying about competition, it's interesting. When I first started practicing Zen, I wasn't expecting to find any of that with Zen people.
Competition,
yeah. And then I started noticing the, I want to be the first kid on my block to have a raksu, you know. I want to be the first kid on my block to get enlightened. So it doesn't go away, you know, when you, and everyone's basically the same, you know. Even if we're trying to not be that way, it's still there, isn't it?
Well, and to see, so our practice is to see the arising of that. I think that so when we first come, we might imagine that Zen is some other world and we're going to get into it. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is what we see is, oh, this is the world. And so we see in ourselves that we are not some pure, holy beings. So we see the arising of jealousy, the arising of... Mm-hmm. of the hungry ghost mind, and that seeing itself is our practice. Yeah.
Along this line here, I was kind of astonished and appalled the first time I heard of the term Dharma combat, that I think is particularly a Tibetan practice of challenging. No?
It's a Zen practice.
Zen practice too, okay. But I was just like astonished that just didn't seem to fit into what was this about. But I saw not so long ago a little some film, and it showed Tibetan monks. This is where I thought it was Tibetan, who were in a courtyard, and they would challenge each other. You know, this Johnson, and here's my question to you to see if you can get it.
Mm-hmm. And they were grinning and having a great time, and it wasn't like anybody was shamed and crumbled. It was really an interesting experience, and I thought, wow, that's been with me for a long time to think about, well, that's a different way of looking at it, mm-hmm. to not be doing this to win. Mm-hmm. You know, right. It's very interesting.
Yeah, that style, that it's called debate rather than combat, but it's taught to Tibetan monks. That's what they learn, and they, you know, they it is like it's like fencing, or
yeah,
you know,
it
it's
looks
a sport.
Like fencing.
It's an intellectual, hard, physicalized sport. But in Zen, we have this thing that is truly called Dharma combat. Mm-hmm. I think what's the translation of it? Is it Hosen? I'm not sure, but the also, form, yeah. We don't use it here. Well, we do every once in a while. There's a sabaton that's put in front of the teacher's seat, and you actually have to, you don't just, it's not like our Dharma dialogue. We changed the name to Dharma dialogue.
I noticed we're serving chocolate on Satine now, too.
Oh, that was a gift.
Just on coming in. It's the subtle teaching of coming and going.
People do, every once in a while, like, you know, people bring food and tea, and we just put it out because it's coming and going.
Yeah. I saw that done once at, John Lurie was doing it at Zen Mountain Monastery, and I have to say I was not comfortable with it, you know, the Dharma combat, because somebody got up and started to say something, and he shouted, "Cut the shit!" You know, and I went, "Ooh, man, that's nasty, you know, I don't want to hear that, you know." This is just the style that they do it, but I did see a film recently of Tibetan monks do it, and they get a lot more fervent about it than that. There's the film Wheel of Time. Werner Herzog did this film about the Dalai Lama at Bodh Gaya, and they show them just shouting at each other, shaking their fists, and they get very, very
it's very animated.
Yeah, very dramatic to watch. Yeah. And of course, you can't understand a word they're saying, which makes it even more content.
The Hosen, we do this.
Yeah, and, that's what I was about to say.
It's surprising to see that, too. And it's kind of funny because I'll hear people say, oh, that person was just getting softball questions, you know.
this Hosen ceremony that means Dharma combat, Mark and Steve were exchanging a little wink because last year Steve was our shuso for this coming and going session. And so people did, we did set up a cushion, and you came up and right, and a bunch of people came up.
Gave him a really hard time.
You were so mean, Mark.
Oh, God.
Mark is the one that's the hard question.
I really did. Energy in this. So the intention is, it's like a public doksa. So they're like, there are two cushions in doksan, and one person comes forward, and because it's public, and it apparently used to be public in ancient China, everyone benefits from the exchange. And we just took the cushion out, but there is this one ceremony that when we have a shuso, someone who has taken over the retreat, we don't have one this year, there's a way to do it if your personality is very aggressive, and there's a way to do it if your personality is more communal. And again, every Zen teacher has different styles. We had a guest teacher here once who did that more aggressive style that Paul's talking about. It wasn't Dido Lorio, it was somebody else. And I remember sitting here, and he had a student demonstrate how to do it. Mm-hmm. And it was just punch, punch, punch. Mm-hmm. But there's another way to do it, and I think that what we've done is a real yearning that comes up.
It's more of a drawing.
Right. And it's just like in Doksan. So, and, you know, I think the questions that people asked you, I'm recalling last year, were really sincere.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And very heartfelt. And that's what we encourage. Yeah. But it's just a style. It's like Sweden and the U.S. It's Zen Mountain Monastery and Bang Sui.
It usually ends with, you need to sit more. You know, which is true of everyone.
Not in our way.
No, okay.
But that is the ultimate answer. Yeah. And so I think, let's stop here and sit.